Thank you very much, and thank you for having me tonight. This is putting me in mind of the experience I had giving a paper when I was first working on DPhil, and I talked to a group at Nuffield, and they were very polite, but there were a lot of really probing questions. And there were also, the worst sign of all, there were compliments about my PowerPoint presentation layout, which meant that it was tragic. And it threw me into enough of a tailspin that I went back and rewrote my application for transfer of status, which was much better than the one that I had handed in the previous week. And it replaced the one, and it all turned out fine, but I can't rewrite this book, so I hope this is a little better than that. Ian McLean and I, last year, had this bright idea to write a book, and one of the triggers for this were some general statements that were being made, primarily by, I have to say, religious leaders, about the immutable character of marriage. And we got to thinking about this, and we thought, well, that, of course, is a positive empirical question, but then there might be important normative questions about, you know, how you treat marriage in a civil society. And so the first idea was to think through carefully, historically and legally, what had happened to marriage in the UK over the past 200, 300, 400 years without going into too much detail. So this is a book for an intelligent layperson, not for an academic expert of any kind. This is directed at policymakers, voters. One of the chapters has a subheader about what you write to your legislator if you're concerned about these things. What kinds of arguments should you be making when you're trying to convince somebody about what public policy should be on these issues? So we begin the book, actually even before that bullet point at the top there, we have a short summary of the rapid change, which all of you know well, that's happened about public attitudes towards same-sex relationships over the past 20 years. And those of us who are older than, you know, 30 or even 40, remember, you know, that it was just inconceivable that we'd be talking about something like same-sex marriage. And of course now we are. And one of the big cleavages in public attitudes about this, there's the religious cleavage, but the biggest cleavage is actually the age cleavage, because people who are under about 24 to 30 just have far fewer problems with this. Committed religious people tend to have more problems with it. People who are committed and attend religious services have more problems with it yet. So this is something that's changing very rapidly. And there are subgroups in the population that have very extreme objections to it. So in political science, one of the ways we talk about politics is how we handle those kinds of differences and how we resolve them. Do we do it with the judiciary? Do we do it with the legislature? What kinds of accommodations have to be made for minorities? And if those accommodations are made, how far do they reach out? What's the scope that should be offered? So we start out with theories of marriage and talk about the vast differences even between religious ideas of marriage. Most Muslims will talk to you in language about how westernized Islam has become and how polygamy, for example, is not practiced by Muslims in Western countries. As a matter of fact, though, there is immigration by Muslims from foreign countries, and the UK has been extremely advanced about dealing with that problem. It was in the 1970s when the marriage laws were modified so that divorce courts could give relief to marriages to the wives of people who were married to multiple wives. In the United States, we haven't had that level of accommodation for Islam. Largely, I think, and this is completely speculative on my part, but largely I think that lack of accommodation for plural marriage in the United States comes from our extremely violent struggles that we had with the Mormons in Utah. At one point in the 19th century, the army was actually called out and sent into Utah with the idea that they would stamp out plural marriage in that state. And before Utah could become a state in the United States, it was necessary for one of the prophets to have a new revelation that polygamy was no longer something that was allowed in the Mormon faith. So our historical problems with plural marriage have been so much more deep-seated that that's been a big problem in the United States, where it hasn't been such a problem for civil society in the UK. The main focus, the two historical chapters that are of the most importance in the book, are about Scotland and England, both of which have completely different marriage regimes. Scotland, as you will all, some of you may know, many of you may know, Scotland had a different Reformation from England. England's Reformation was triggered by the divorce of Henry VIII from Catherine of Aragon. But that did not happen in Scotland. He was not King of Scotland at the time. And in fact, the Scottish Reformation is a much more continental Reformation. It's Calvinist in its origins. So in Scotland, marriage continued to be a largely individual relationship. Divorce was allowed from the 16th century in Scotland. And in England, the first law uniformly regulating marriage was passed in 1753. It was Lord Hardwicke's Act. And the problem that was designed to solve was that there were marriages taking place between basically rich heiresses and poor young men who wanted to marry their way to the aristocracy. And if you look at the parliamentary debates on that act, most of the people who opposed it were arguing for the sanctity of marriage, because they were arguing that religious values upheld their right to marry whomever they wanted under whatever circumstances they wanted to marry them. But in fact, what they wanted to do was to marry someone wealthy, and it could be tracked through some of the leading people arguing against this law, that they were people who either had married up or planned to marry up, because they did later. So basically, this is an economic regulation that has to do with keeping money in the hands of certain families and making sure that people weren't working outside of their social class. That act excludes two important groups. The other thing that does, so the operational part of the act is to make sure that parents gave their approval before people under 21 were married. But in order to ensure that, the Act also gives a legal monopoly to the Church of England, so that anyone who was married in this country, in England, had to be married in the Church of England. They could not be married in any other denomination, unless you were a Quaker or a Jew. Both of those two groups were excluded and were allowed to maintain their own records, were allowed to conduct ceremonies on their own premises, and the Quakers remain to this day the only people who don't even have to conduct their weddings on religious premises that are licensed. This continues on, and there are big debates in the literature about whether this act is universally applicable or whether people are getting married outside of the Church of England. I think the best evidence is by Rebecca Probert, who's a graduate of this university, who argues that most people were, after 1753, getting married in their parish church just as they had done before that. But this monopoly continues on until civil marriage in 1836 is introduced. The Great Reform Act happens in 1832. One of the big debates during that is religious equality. And in 1836, it becomes possible for nonconformist ministers to conduct wedding ceremonies, also Roman Catholics. But both of those kinds of religious people also have to have registered buildings so that the state is monitoring where the marriage takes place. And if you're not an Anglican, you have to have a civil registrar present at your wedding. Okay? So because these nonconformists are seen as not as well educated, they move around a lot, they're not Church of England, they're not reliable to marry people, so that it's necessary to have an agent of the state present at those religious weddings. Ireland is a whole nightmare of its own, as it always is in the UK. And in Ireland, it was actually illegal for a Roman Catholic to marry a Roman Catholic to a Protestant. And there is at least one documented instance of a priest in Ireland being executed for intermarrying Protestants with Catholics. So what we can see here is that for this period of time, basically the church is acting as an agent for the state. This is not a case where marriage is coming from the ground up and being allowed to become something that is a part of religious communities. Instead, basically we have the Church of England model acting here, so that we have a state church that is permitted to conduct a state activity, and that activity is marrying people in a way that's recognized by the state. That does not, I hasten to add, mean that there weren't any people getting married other ways. Despite Rebecca Probert's work, it seems fairly clear to me that if you didn't have property, nobody cared, and you could get married wherever you wanted to, and by whomever you want to. And if the community treated you as married, then that was fine, because there wasn't any issue with inheritance of property or other things like tools, but, you know, not minor things like that. Okay, one of the things that we're trying to divide things up into in this book is what does matter and what doesn't matter. And we adopt a candidly Rawlsian approach to this debate, because we think that it's important for people to communicate in order to make good policy decisions. That doesn't mean that if I'm a Christian, I can't say I'm a Christian and I oppose opposite sex marriage, but I have to be able to come up with good empirical or normative or other kinds of arguments that will make sense not just to Christians, but to non-Christians, to Jews, Muslims, and atheists and humanists and all kinds of other people. So we want to try to eliminate some of the arguments that seem to us to fall out on the non-Rawlsian end of the spectrum. The first, and I think the most annoying argument that's offered constantly, and you'll hear it over and over next week in the House of Lords, is this argument about consummation and adultery. And I'm going to skip back and forth for a half a second here, but this is a group of adults, and so I'm going to repeat. Les Green, who is a law professor in the university and is a fellow at Balliol, says that consummation under English common law is the penetration of a vagina by a penis to a depth and for a duration sufficient to please the trier of fact. Okay, what that means is those two issues are questions of fact for a jury or a judge. And when you start reading cases, and there are published cases where people contest whether a marriage has been consummated or whether adultery has been engaged in, they are disgusting. They need to go into horrendous amounts of detail about people's private lives, what they can and can't do in the bedroom, and those kinds of things. And I think the very first thing we need to do is to start eliminating arguments about what has gone on in the bedroom. It's just not appropriate. So when we start looking at the civil impact of those particular kinds of arguments, what I've done is a little chart here to show there are certain legal grounds still that are required to be proven if they're contested in English law to grant a divorce. So the general standard is irretrievable breakdown, okay? But the factual bases for that are desertion, separation, adultery, or unreasonable behavior. Unreasonable behavior can mean anything, including not having sex that doesn't have to be the kind of sex I just described, okay? So if you start from 1974, at that time, about 30% of the petitions that were based on adultery were ones that were granted, okay? This adultery as a basis for a granted petition for divorce was about 30%. About 25% is unreasonable behavior. But you can see how that has dropped, and this has increased almost at the same rate. So that what we've got now is about roughly just under 50% of the divorce petitions in England and Wales are being granted on unreasonable behavior grounds, which can be a number of things, and adultery is clear down here. And I would be willing to bet, the numbers aren't out there that I've been able to find, but I would be willing to bet that the large percentage of these are just completely uncontested. So wife walks in, does a petition, alleges adultery, husband doesn't deny it, and nobody ever has to prove anything. It's just a basis, okay? So I just think this is good. This is a really good way of seeing how resistant people are becoming to having these kinds of things be the basis for legal decisions. That does not mean, by the way, and I want to keep emphasizing this evening, that does not mean that they cannot be the basis for moral decisions or for religious decisions. No one is arguing that the Roman Catholic Church, for example, should have to remarry people who have been divorced. No one is arguing that any given religious group should have to marry anybody. But I think that it's important for civil law to start recognizing these kinds of trends broadly. Let me run quickly back through what doesn't matter. Another thing that doesn't matter, natural law arguments can be offered, but they definitely count as what Rawls would call a comprehensive reasonable doctrine, so that they are based on premises that are not necessarily going to be accepted, certainly not by any legal positivist who believes that law comes out of a barrel of a gun. Okay, so our job, if we're trying to convince a positivist, is to come up with consequences of marriage that the positivist will agree are undesirable ones. Polygamy is another one. Now, I think that there could be interesting arguments about that. I come out different ways on different days. But I think that polygamy is one also that has not been argued well. If someone's going to do it, it'd be great. But I don't think that one's been made. What does matter? Absolutely what matters. One, transportability. We live in a devolved state. Scotland has different laws on marriage from England. Northern Ireland has different laws on marriage from England as well. So once we have a law, we have to have a regime where people's expectations will be met. They don't get surprised. And I'll talk a little bit more about that if we have time at the end, because I want to spend more time on religious freedom. But I think the most important of these issues, certainly the most important for tonight, is religious freedom. And I just want to run through a quick theoretical underpinning for what the book talks about, and then talk about how that applies in real life, including under the statute that's been introduced and will be debated next week in the House of Lords. I want to argue that sexual orientation and religious belief have important core characteristics that are identical. Now, some of you may disagree with me, and I'm willing to, but if you grant that certain characteristics are true about sexual orientation, then there's a really curious identity between these two. Both involve an unchosen expression of one's identity, okay? You don't gain or lose your faith because you decide to. In most cases. In most cases, I would resist giving up my faith, and I would want that to remain, but I might lose it through doubt or something involuntary on my own part, but it wouldn't be a choice that I would make. Same is true, most people would argue, with regard to sexual orientation. It is not something that you choose, it's something that is an innate characteristic. Second, both have merged conduct and identity dimensions. Now, there are many people who would say, okay, we do not condemn homosexuality per se. We condemn homosexual behavior. The problem is that cuts equally when you start talking about religion. We don't condemn religious belief. You can believe whatever you want. All we condemn is religious behavior. But you can see that makes absolutely no sense to a committed Christian. So we want to say that that's another characteristic of sexual orientation and religious belief that is very analogous. Third, both are intensely relational, involving partner, in many cases of religion, I'm saying there, a higher being, and recognition of that relationship in a community. And finally, both create really important duties and responsibilities with regard to oneself and with regard to other people. So once we've admitted that, then we're going to be putting things on a par so that we have to be able to talk about both at the same time. And now I want to give you three cases. The first is Vanessa Woolock and Elaine Photography. This is a New Mexico case. New Mexico does not have same-sex marriage or even civil partnership, although they recognize same-sex marriage from other jurisdictions. But this was a couple from New Mexico who wanted to have just a commitment ceremony. And a photographer, Elaine Photography, she was listed in the Yellow Pages from time to time, and she advertised on the internet. She refused to photograph the wedding. She said, I object to that on moral grounds, and I'm not going to do it. She was found liable under New Mexico's anti-discrimination statute on sexual orientation. You've all heard, I'm sure, of Steve Preddy and Martin Hall, who wanted to have a trip to Wales, and they called up the Bulls, who ran the Chamorva camp. Chamorva? Anybody Welsh? I can't pronounce Welsh words, but I'm going to say Chamorva Hotel. The Bulls had a policy of only renting double bedrooms to married couples. And on their website, they had a notice that said, we're committed Christians and we only want to have married couples in double rooms. And they also had a policy that when they answered the phone and took a reservation on the phone, they told people that they would only rent a double room to a married couple. And unfortunately, the day that, I think it was Steve Preddy called to make the reservation, unfortunately Mrs. Bull was not well, and she said she forgot to make the statement about married couples, and so they didn't get noticed. They show up at the hotel, and they can't stay there. They go down the street to the police station, and they find another place that they have to stay. They were, the Bulls, as you know, were found liable for sexual orientation discrimination. There were damages awarded in that case. Finally, and this is a very recent case, James Fairbanks and Alan Beret wanted to buy a conference center that was being sold by the Diocese of Worcester, Massachusetts. And the diocese terminated negotiations with them. And the email, after the negotiations were terminated, the lawyer for the diocese inadvertently sent confidential emails to Fairbanks and Beret. And this is a smoking gun. Lawyers love smoking guns. This is an email from one of the people in the diocese, the chancellor, I think, to his outside counsel. I just went down the hall and discussed it with the bishop, the sale of the conference center. Because of the potentiality of gay marriages there, something you shared with us yesterday, we aren't interested in going forward with these buyers. I think they're shaky anyway. So just tell them that we will not accept their revised plan and the diocese is making new plans for the property. You find the language. Okay. So clearly they were worried that there would be same-sex weddings taking place on the property if they sold it. Their argument is that these guys really couldn't get financing for the purchase anyway. But in fact, it's pretty clear from the email that that wasn't what was concerning them. Now, Fairbanks and Beret said they hadn't even thought about having any same-sex weddings there when they were involved in the process. They are married, by the way, Fairbanks and Beret. They were married in Massachusetts. And they said they hadn't even thought about having same-sex marriages, but the person who bought the conference center has publicly announced he will never have same-sex marriages on the premises. Okay, so that's kind of our little suite of cases that I want to run through. Now I want to go through some, I want to check my time. Yeah, good. About 45 minutes or so, is that what we usually do? That's, I think, what was in my
lead. Yeah, okay.
I want to run through some models with you, and then we can talk about applying the models to the facts, and then we'll talk about the actual statute that's going to be considered again in Parliament next week. This is a model proposed by Kai Feldblum, and Feldblum says, what we should do is we should start out and say ministers should be able to refuse to perform same-sex weddings, and religious organizations can be exempt from recognizing same-sex marriages so long as they're performing religious functions. So if you've got a Baptist organization that runs tours to the Holy Land and it offers different kinds of packages for different couples, Feldblum would say they should be allowed to not have same-sex married couples participate in that tour of the Holy Land. He goes so far as to say even leaders of non-religious organizations that are owned by religious entities, I should say, instead of people probably. So he's talking more about the Roman Catholic Church, Episcopal Church, whatever. If it's a non-religious organization that's owned by a religious organization, may be required, for example, not to be in a same-sex relationship. His conception of that is that there may be leadership decisions that have to be made that are discretionary so that the value system is important enough in that leadership position that you don't want to have someone who's in a same-sex marriage that's violative of the denomination's doctrine in that position of leadership and making those decisions. Now notice, none of the believers in the examples would be protected by this model, okay? So a photographer, no way. That's not a leader it's a skill, and there's also a big fight about copyright in that case. But she won't be protected. The Bulls certainly wouldn't be protected, and certainly sale of property down here would not be protected. This is a more interesting model, and this comes out with, this is much, much broader. And You folks, if you're keeping up with these things, I'm sure you're familiar with the Ouida case. Lillian Ouida was the Islington registrar who did not want to perform civil union ceremonies. And this, it's not Ouida, sorry. My brain's fried tonight. Liddell, Lillian Liddell. She was the Islington registrar who refused to perform same-sex ceremonies. And that blew up because she had actually been not performing civil partnerships for quite some time successfully, but there was a diversity policy in the office, and some of the other employees felt insulted by the fact that she wouldn't do this because she didn't approve of their lifestyle. And so she basically was fired from her job. She took that to the European Court of Human Rights, and she has lost that case. I am actually really sympathetic with Liddell. I think she was hired by Section 28. One of the arguments that's seldom made in that case is she was hired when Section 28 was in effect. So if you really believe that same-sex relationships are bad, certainly Section 28, which prohibited local authorities from, and particularly schools, from advancing positive messages about same-sex relationships, same-sex marriage was way out of the ballpark at that time. So I think you have to make some kind of adjustment for people who are hired under one set of circumstances so that they don't suddenly, the ground comes out from under them and they have to do something that they couldn't possibly have anticipated when they were hired. This is a woman, Robin Fretwell Wilson in the United States is basically the one who has come up with this theory. And again, if we start with the Islington Registrar example, she hypothesizes a registry office where there are four employees: faith, hope, charity, and efficiency. And of those four, faith is the one who objects to same-sex weddings, and so or same-sex marriage. And so her concept is that you have efficiency out at the front desk, and when Mary and John come in wanting to have a civil marriage, you do all the paperwork, and you send them either to Hope or Charity, but not to Faith. And that way, Mary and John never know that they're being directed to one person, and you maintain Faith's integrity in her religious beliefs, and everything's fine. Now, this all turns on a cost-benefit analysis, because if, for example, you're way out in the country and there's only one registrar, it's not going to work. But a lot of this stuff does go on in the cities, and so substantially larger proportion of same-sex marriages are going to happen in larger cities. And she thinks that the bureaucracy can handle that. So her overall principle is that provided that the same-sex couple can find the relevant goods, services, at minimum cost from another provider, a religious provider can discriminate and refuse to provide those goods and services. Now, there's an immediate objection to this. One of the things that they also say is that they should give notice, so that you wouldn't be surprised. Okay, so if I'm Jeff and Steve, and I want to go to a bed and breakfast, the Bulls need to put a notice on the website in their advertisement saying, we only rent double rooms to married couples, opposite sex couples. I'll have to say if they're same-sex marriage. Now, the obvious objection to that, which you get from the people who are against this kind of exemption, is that this kind of a notice sounds exactly like no Irish need to apply for certain kinds of jobs in the last century. So they see that as a kind of a bad discriminatory move that really could make discrimination acceptable. If you start seeing all those signs up and down in every bed and breakfast, then you start to see an acceptance for what they view as discrimination that is something they find unacceptable. So, one way to deal with that is to put the burden on, and remember we're talking about the burden is, in the first case, was on the couple to show that they couldn't get the same service at a minimal cost. Let's go back for half a second to my three cases. Fretwell Wilson points out that in the, and I've actually double-checked this, in the New Mexico phone book around the city where this ceremony took place in the first case, there are all kinds of photographers. It would not have been difficult, as long as a lady photographer told them on the phone, "Oh, we don't do same-sex weddings." Another phone number would have been minimal effort, okay? Again, here, this is going to depend, but the facts of the Preddy and Hall against Bull case seem to indicate that they went to the police station, they right away got another place to stay. So, you know, maybe $50 worth or 50 pounds worth of money to repay them for the expense of us not remembering to notify them when they were on the phone that we didn't rent those rooms to unmarried couples. Third, this one probably would not be covered, even under Frutler Wilson's model, because property is unique. So I think this one would be the one that would fall out there. Another way to do this is to shift the burden to the provider, the religious believer, and make them show that the service was available. Now that could easily be done with some kind of a, not just the notice, but also maybe a little booklet of other facilities that offer the same service that are nearby, so that people don't have to stay at that particular bed and breakfast. And to impose a substantial penalty if they fail to do that. Okay, if they really do discriminate, people can't find another place to stay, they weren't notified, you can impose a fairly substantial penalty and give people disincentive. Serious believers, and I'm not sure I've phrased the third bullet point right here, serious believers will be willing to incur serious risk, but will have an incentive to be sure that there are alternatives. They may be willing to incur serious risk. They're going to object at the political level, though. I think we'd all hate to think that we were going to get fined an enormous amount if we didn't meet some kind of a indeterminate legal standard. But what I'm trying to show here is that these kinds of tests can be fine-tuned depending on how we want to adjust for different groups' rights and responsibilities. All right, now, on to the UK. The statute that is being considered in the Parliament has what's called the quadruple lock. And these are the four elements of the quadruple lock. First, no religious organization or individual can be compelled to marry a same-sex couple. Second, so the meaning of that is that an organization or denomination, so say in a congregational church, that's going to be the congregation, in a hierarchical church like the Roman Catholic Church, that's going to be the whole denomination, they have to opt in before they can conduct same-sex marriages. And when they opt in, individual clergy can still refuse to perform same-sex marriages. Okay? So even if I'm a Roman Catholic priest, and now, I think this starts to get a little bit weird here, but assuming that I'm a Roman Catholic priest, the Roman Catholic faith decides that same-sex marriage is fine, I can still say no, I don't want to, and I won't be violating any civil law if that's the case. Okay. Second, refusal to marry a same-sex couple is not discrimination under the Equality Act 2010. Third, no religious same-sex marriage on religious premises unless the religious organization explicitly opts in. And fourth, they had to make a very anomalous exception. There's arguably a common law duty on the part of the Church of England and the Church in Wales to marry people who live within the precincts of the parish. And that duty will not include same-sex marriage. So those are the four locks that are in place to protect religious freedom. Now, what we have to ask is, how well does the actual statutory language fit into the models that I've talked about up here? So the operational language about non-discrimination is this. A is a person, does not contravene this section, and that's the non-discrimination section on sexual orientation. If A does not conduct a relevant marriage, that's a same-sex marriage, B is not present at, does not carry out, or does not otherwise participate in a relevant marriage, or C does not consent to a relevant marriage being conducted, for the reason that the marriage is the marriage of a same-sex couple, and that consent probably has most to do with consent to use premises, buildings, okay? Now, the government has helpfully provided a set of, and I had not seen these before I came up with my cases up here, but they've done a great job. The governing body of a religious organization needs to consider whether to opt in to conducting same-sex marriage according to its rights. It decides not to. This would be lawful, and no member of the governing body nor the organization itself could be forced by legal action or otherwise to change its decision. Okay? So that's pretty clear. That's model one. A religious organization opts into conducting same-sex marriages. However, one of the organization's ministers does not approve of same-sex marriage and does not wish to solemnize such a marriage. This would be lawful. The religious organization arranges for an alternative minister to conduct the same-sex marriage ceremony. Third, a person who acts as an authorized person at marriages in her local church does not wish to do so in relation to same-sex marriages, even though the church has opted into same-sex marriage. It would be lawful for her to refuse. A civil registrar is asked to step in to cover that role. It would be unlawful sexual orientation discrimination for him to refuse because he does not approve of same-sex marriage. So that's the Lily Liddell case. Even though the person who's acting on behalf of the religious group can refuse to perform the marriage, once it's an employee of the state, an agent of the state, the person can no longer do that. No room for faith, hope, charity, and efficiency. Okay? Fourth, an organist who usually plays at wedding services at a church does not wish to play at a same-sex wedding service. This would be lawful because he is involved in a religious act of worship, i.e. the religious ritual of the wedding service. This is not the case whether he is a volunteer, this is the case whether he is a volunteer or employed by the church. Okay? So that's, again, participating in the ceremony. Next, a commercial photographer is asked to photograph a wedding of a same-sex couple. I swear to not read this before I did the whole entire. It would be unlawful, there are florists and bakers and photographers, the ones in the United States. It's all over, all the courts right now. Commercial photographer is asked to photograph a wedding of a same-sex couple. It would be unlawful sexual orientation discrimination for her to refuse because she does not approve of same-sex marriage. This is because her role is not part of the religious marriage service. Here's another, this is a really good one. A volunteer flower arranger who usually decorates the place of worship for wedding services does not wish to do so for a same-sex wedding because she does not approve of same-sex marriage. This would be lawful because the service she offers is not covered by the Equality Act 2010 as it is a service to the church rather than to the couple. It would not be lawful for a commercial flower arranger to refuse a request by a same-sex couple to decorate the wedding venue because he does not approve of same-sex marriage. This is because the service he offers is to the couple and his role is not part of the religious marriage service. Finally, a chaplain employed by a university is asked to solemnize the same-sex marriage of an employee of the university. Although his religious organization has opted into same-sex marriage, he refuses because he does not wish to marry a same-sex couple. This is lawful. The university makes alternative arrangements by finding an alternative chaplain to conduct the ceremony. So this is how they're coming down, and basically they're quite close to model one, not to model two. Certainly there's no exclusion for registrars. Once you're in the market, you're in the market, and the market is regulated in terms of non-discrimination. There's no real room for anything else to happen. Now I want to draw one final set of distinctions. The first is between jurisdictions where judges decide that same-sex marriage is a right. This has happened in South Africa, this has happened in Canada, this has happened in the United States in some states. In those cases, rarely, certainly in a judicial decision, you're not going to get the same kinds of protections that are offered by a legislature. And so in legislatures, you frequently get much better protections than you would get if things were pushed to the edge and it was a judge that decided the case. Now, I'm going to go way out on a hypothetical limb here, and I'll actually argue that the UK is much better off with a legislature that's dealing with this than it would be if, for some reason, it was necessary for the Supreme Court to have to deal with it. Because I think you'd have a lot less sympathy with religious beliefs religious groups would have a lot less power than they have in the legislature. And so the level of accommodation that's coming from the House of Lords and the House of Commons for religious belief is going to be better than the alternative would have been had there been a different body deciding the question. I also want to say that this can reach fairly broad proportions, and I'll just use New York State as an example, which has just recently passed a same-sex marriage law. Extremely generous exemptions for religious groups, including one that protects them. I mean, in the United universities aren't such a big deal, and because universities are public generally, and so it ends up not being. But because in the United States we have whole religious universities that offer married student housing, and then some of them are in Massachusetts. You get these big problems with this kind of stuff. And so New York, for example, has passed really generous exemptions, including one that says religious organizations and their auxiliaries and ancillaries do not need to rent or sell property if the use of the property is going to be inconsistent with the tenets of the faith. So in that case, you finally get down to the Worcester, Massachusetts Conference Center case, where at least arguably, that refusal, even with my smoking gun email, it would be perfectly legitimate under New York law to refuse to sell property to a same-sex married couple based on the fact that you were afraid that they were going to conduct same-sex weddings on the premises. So this is a range of options that's available. I think, and I'll just take questions. What I'm going to do now, this is 45 minutes, so I'll stop and take questions. I think some of you wanted to talk about freedom of speech and those things. Some of those things can be important. What I haven't talked about that I really do care a lot about, too, is this whole difference between transportability in the United States and here. Here, it will relate more to transportability within the EU. In the United States, it's interstate kinds of relationships. What happens when a couple that's been married in Massachusetts moves to Texas? And it's a same-sex couple, they get married happily in Massachusetts, they're happy and they move down for a job in Texas, and sure enough the relationship falls apart. What do? They can't get a divorce in Massachusetts because they're no longer residents of Massachusetts, and Texas has a constitutional amendment saying they won't recognize same-sex marriage. So what happens next? And worse, what happens when there are kids in those kinds of cases? So we have to come up with principles for dealing with them. Happy to talk about that too.
Well, thanks so much, Scott. And luckily, he's left us plenty of time for questions. Go ahead and open the floor up and fire away.
Sort of about what you're talking about on the first slide about how marriage has sort of evolved over time and hasn't been seen as an institution. And I was wondering about at what period when marriage was sort of, I think particularly in England, like medieval era, it was like a speech act. And when did the state get involved enough? Clearly by 1753, there was an uprise for dealing with that. But where did it go from? Like, the two people said marriage vows, they were legally married.
So before 1753, it was a promise de verba, no, per verba de presenti. And it's a promise in the words of the present tense. And you could just do that together by yourselves. That was true in Scotland until the 20th century. People, and they had what they called marriage lines, so that one partner would write to the other, I love you very much, and I feel that I am now married to you after our promises the other night, or something like that. And that was legally enforceable in Scotland. It's really the watershed of 1753.
And you think that was from that economic motivation or something like that?
Yeah. It's pretty clear, mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, churches regulated it before that, right? So I'm not arguing that churches didn't have different rules. One of the most important sets of rules are rules about incest. And those vary depending on which part of the Reformation you follow, or whether you follow it at all, right? So Roman Catholics, up until recently, I don't know what recent Roman Catholic doctrine is on this, but
There were times when you were prohibited from marrying people who were related to you through your godparents in the Catholic Church, whereas in the Protestant tradition, those tend to narrow down quite a lot. Certainly.
Thanks for your talk. I'd be interested to hear more about transportability. It's such a tangle, I guess. Where are things going? What do you think?
Well, in the UK, it's rational. This is one of these places where the UK law will make sense, no matter what happens in the next few weeks, because the government has recognized that Northern Ireland is not going to have same-sex marriage in the near future. And so same-sex marriages performed in England and Wales will be treated as civil partnerships in Northern Ireland. And there's no need for the Northern Irish to change any laws or do anything differently. In the United States, it's a great story. Full faith and credit is the name of the doctrine in the Constitution, where all states have to give full faith and credit to the public acts of the other states. So in theory, that means that marriages and divorces that happen in Texas are valid. If it's valid according to the law of the place where the marriage was celebrated, it's valid everywhere else. Now there's a core problem that's designed to address. Cousins. In some states in the United States, you can marry your cousins, and some you can't. But even if, as long as you can marry your cousin, and you do in a state that allows that, then that marriage is valid where you go. Okay? So that is the general rule. Now, there's a public policy exception to the full faith and credit clause. And the public policy exception says that states don't have to recognize public acts, and particularly marriages, when they're against the public policy of state. That was designed for a very specific case, too, interracial marriage. Southern states wouldn't recognize it. And there was just too big a fight to have, so politically, that was the way to do it. You design a public policy exception that gets you out of this horrible problem that you're in with that. So the full faith and credit clause is not going to solve the problems. That's the bottom line there. And so there are basically three or four kinds of cases that need to be addressed when people are traveling. One is, okay, you've got James and Tom who are from Utah who travel to Massachusetts and get married and then return, and they never had any intention of staying in Massachusetts. Should that marriage be recognized? Probably not, frankly, by Utah. There's a constitutional amendment against it. Utah has certain benefits that they give to same-sex couples. So the interest of the state in its citizens or residents' marriages is sufficiently great that you might want to allow exceptions in a case like that. Now, the really strong case the other way is the couple from Massachusetts who are on vacation in Florida. And one tragically is, I don't know, something horrible happens and they need a legal remedy. And so should they be allowed to go to court when they're there on vacation? And I'm trying to think. Something happens to their child, right? And so they need to be able to have access to the courts. Well, will the court recognize a same-sex marriage in that case? Okay, probably that should happen, okay? And then the intermediate case is the one I just described in Texas. That's a horrible nightmare. These two guys got married, and I can't tell you the caption of the case, but they got married in Massachusetts, went down to Texas, and this is now in the Texas Supreme Court. When they first went to court, the probate court judge, where they went for their divorce, said, yeah, I'll do that. That's not a problem. I can just apply all these laws, and you've got to be treated the way anybody in Texas would be treated, and do it. And the state intervened to stop the judge from doing that. And that's been on appeal now for 2 years with this stuff. The interesting thing is that even without a divorce, you can still have a property division. So there's some ideological things happening in that case as well. But at some point, there is a dignitary interest in having this relationship and the legal side of it recognized by the state. So they have something to fly on there. And it's been a little tangle. And then when you start getting involved in international questions, UK people traveling to Austria or one of the countries in the EU that really has low levels of tolerance for, say, Malta, low levels of tolerance for same-sex couples and same-sex relationships, it's really, really difficult to try to reconcile all of it. Probably what's happening right now, the European Court of Human Rights in the last case, Schalk and Kopp, hinted that there may be a floor for recognizing same-sex couples' relationships legally. There's already precedent in terms of countries that offer opposite-sex partners who are not married various kinds of rights of succession to property, like under tenancy agreements. One of the two tenants dies. They've been in a long-term relationship. Had they been an opposite-sex couple, the other one would be allowed to succeed to the tenancy. But in fact, they're a same-sex couple, and that's not recognized. European Court of Human Rights basically said that is not allowed. And so, and there may actually, after Schalk against Kopp, be some moderate level of civil union / civil partnership, reciprocal beneficiary relationship that will be required under the European Convention on Human Rights. But that's in the future, and nobody ever knows what the ECHR is going to do. Those are the issues. There are no clear answers. It's going to be very, and I think that's a fair thing. Again, if we're talking about fighting fair, I think it's perfectly legitimate. Do I have to do another slide? Oh yeah, I've got a set of four things that are being. And there's low cost to a lot of this stuff. An exemption for registrars with a conscientious objection, right? You know, I don't see that costing the government that much to go with the faith, hope, charity, and efficiency kind of model. But a lot of people think that once you're a government employee, you have to comply with government policy, and government policy is we have same-sex marriage, and so these employees should have to toe the line. Free speech exemption, allowing conscientious objection to same-sex marriage. I think that's there already. If somebody wants it more articulated than it is now, the government's making arguments about how, well, if we have one here, then the statutes that don't have one will be vulnerable to challenge. I think that's a little bit of a legalistic game to play. Equal rights for opposite-sex couples to enter into civil partnerships. I think it's revealing that the Church of England has said that they oppose that. I think they're worried that that would be an even further dilution of marriage, which that makes good sense to me. And then finally, preventing weddings, including same-sex marriages, to be conducted by human assailants. That really does pose all kinds of problems for the whole marriage regime. So if you want to keep marriages on licensed premises in this country, then you have to do it. I'm not sure you have to do that. The Quakers don't do it. There's already that exception. So all these things are not. But the problem is these things become so politically divisive that the proponents of the bill can't admit to having any additional allowances for people. And I have to say that religious groups do not have the power that they had 20 years ago. And they don't have the power here that they have in the United States. Now, you might think that's a good thing, or you might think it's not such a good thing, if you're religious. Yeah.
As a Christian, trying to step behind Rawls's veil of ignorance for a bit, your previous slide, doesn't it, in privileging religious groups and saying, well, if you're religious, you don't have to do the flower arranging, say, for this, doesn't that put us as Christians on doesn't it give us a kind of unsustainable level of privilege that, say, an atheistic homophobe wouldn't face?
I don't think so, but I have a hard time defending that case. I think that religion is different. I think historically it's been different. I think you guys had a huge civil war. We fought ours about race, you guys did about religion, right? And you've watched things happen in the last century in Northern Ireland and Ireland that are just horrible. And those are based on religion. So I think you need to have as non-discriminatory a policy about religion as you possibly can. And that involves not just accommodation of religion, but it also involves religious equality, and that's a whole different game to get into. But do I think that puts religious groups on into an unsustainably privileged position? I think an atheist would have a hard time defending conscientious objection to same-sex marriage. I can't think how that argument would look. And so the flower arranger, who's a volunteer note in her church, I think is going to have it. Now, should the, I guess the analogy might be to like a fraternal lodge, right? The Elks or the Eagles. If they had licensed premises, but they decided not to allow same-sex weddings, should they be treated the same as religious groups? Hard question. I don't know, that would definitely be worth the courts, because I don't think they qualify under these exemptions at all. So in some sense, I think you're right. If we start trying to think of the really good analogies to religious organizations, atheists, I have, the whole phrase of all beliefs are none, I, as an American and a Christian, I have a really hard time with that. I just don't, that all beliefs are none thing doesn't, I don't understand exactly what that means. Is that?
Could you maybe elaborate on that point, all beliefs are none?
Well, it's just, people of no belief are categorically different from people who have religious beliefs. And I think people with religious beliefs, there are reasons to give them accommodation based on, among other things, the arguments that I said about the characteristics of religious belief. I think that you probably can choose to be an atheist in a way that you can't choose to be a Christian. You become a Christian somehow through either a process of formation from socialization through your family or through some important experience that happens to you when you're in your teens or something like that. But it's not a voluntary, and in a way that I think atheism is. I don't think atheism involves strong duties and obligations or rights of any kind, and it's a community, but only a very incidental one. So I think the characteristics that I was, for the same core characteristic that I think that people who want same-sex marriage based on their sexual orientation should be more willing to talk to people who have strong, really conscientious religious beliefs that make them oppose it. That's kind of my bottom line here. And I don't think atheists really figure into that somehow. Yep.
Within the States, obviously, there's a big fight right now going on over the HHS mandate, the decision by the Obama administration to compel businesses and organizations to provide funding for contraceptives through their insurance plans. Businesses that think of themselves as having distinctly religious orientations, like Hobby Lobby being the most prominent, which is run by a conservative Christian family, are objecting to this on religious grounds. Do you think that their objection is legitimate, or is it just a stalking horse for the gay marriage dispute within the States? Where would you draw the line for what counts as a religious organization against those people who would say, no, my business is in fact an expression of the way in which I run my business, the principles by which I operate it, is in fact itself an expression of a faith that goes all the way through the week and doesn't just happen on Sundays, to use cliches that have been very popular within Christianity for the last 20 years.
It's not bad. It's not bad theology. It's pretty good theology. First of all, the most important response to your point is Robin Fretwell Wilson, who did Model 2, she started out doing healthcare stuff and religious exemptions for abortion, contraception, things like that. So that model is actually designed for exactly the problem you're talking about. Second thing is to say, I do not know about what the scoop is with all this. With the contraceptive cases that have been going on. I have not been following those judgments. I don't necessarily think it's a stalking horse, though. I think this is just one of these same issues where people have really, really strong views, and we have to figure out ways to accommodate between the two. And I think it's the job of lawyers and policymakers to come up with equitable ways of making sure that the policy does not infringe on too many rights. So I think, now, what religious organizations? I mean, you see what's happening here in the UK. I mean, it's clearly, if you're in business and charging money, you can't discriminate. So in the United States, that argument would go, if you're in business, if you're providing business, you have to provide health care, and anybody who provides health care has to provide contraceptive coverage with their health care. That doesn't mean that the people have to use it. So it doesn't mean that Hobby Lobby can't go around to all its employees and say, you know, we're a Christian organization, we really don't think that anybody in this business should be using contraceptives. We provide it, and we're not going to investigate whether you use it or not, but we really, that's our policy, is that we're a Christian organization. We think that people should be Christians 7 days a week, not just one day a week, and that's our policy. So that's a free speech question. And I would support that 150%. It applies to men as well as to women. It's not, right? It's non-controversial. I do think that the cost-benefit analysis is the one that has to be used here. I mean, are those employees, what kind of an impact is it having on the workforce if you allow exemptions for certain groups that are willing to declare that they have fundamental Christian principles guiding their business? I mean, if I'm Jewish, I'm probably not going to want to work for Hobby Lobby, right? They have an overtly Christian ethos in the business. They probably have a non-discrimination policy against Jews. But this is my point. Actually, this drives me also back to my point about these signs. No, Irish need not apply, right? That's the objection to these notices, like the bulls. And like we might say we have this really generous accommodation for religion. We say you need to put a sign up that says no Irish need apply. You know what? I have a really hard time thinking that a gay couple like Preddy and Paul would really want to spend the night in the Bulls guest house if they knew how strongly they disapprove of same-sex couples sharing a double room, right? I mean, if you've got proprietors in your hotel who are not overtly rude, but certainly surly, and feel very put upon that they have to serve you, that's not a great relationship. It's a business relationship, and it's not a good one, right? The most extreme example of this is the Avon Relate case, McFarlane. And this guy hired on to be a counselor with the Avon Relate Industries, and this is one of the four that went to the European Court. And he said, fine, I want to take this advanced thing in psychosexual counseling, and they sent him to a class, and he comes back and says, yeah. I'll do counseling for same-sex couples, but I'm not going to do psychosexual same-sex counseling. Okay? Now, there are just a bunch of problems with that. One of them is, if he knew when he went to the course that he was going to be required to comply with Avon Relate's non-discrimination policy, that was not a wise move on his part. But equally, if you're a same-sex couple, do you want someone who feels that strongly offering sexual counseling? No. It's just not. So a lot of these fights are being set up on, I think, extremely ideological grounds, where people set it up as an issue, as a way to get it out there in front of the public, not really because there are two human beings who have been harmed one way or another. Now, Preddy and Hall versus Bull probably was, that was just a really unfortunate and unpleasant experience for everybody concerned, and it's gone on and dragged on and been horrible for everyone ever since. But I think the Lillian Waddell case is just a really clear instance where there were two groups. One group was overly offended by the fact that she didn't want to do these civil partnerships, despite the fact that she hadn't done them for some time. And then she got really upset and found a lawyer who was willing to represent her, and so the whole thing became an awful, awful public dispute in a way that was not necessarily productive. So, did I answer most of your question, kind of?
Yeah, that's helpful.
We'll come back. Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, I was wondering how this would, for example, apply to, for example, kindergartens that are run by the Catholic Church. They employ a female nurse who's living in a gay relationship. Then she wants to marry her female partner, mm-hmm. and now it becomes public. Is the Catholic Church allowed to unemploy her because of this? Or if the Catholic Church wants to unemploy her, how would the legal situation be?
The employment laws have exemptions for religious organizations, and I will be really honest and admit that I can't tell you exactly what the outcome would be in that case. I can tell you that in Cleveland, Ohio, within the last few weeks, a gym teacher who had been at a Catholic school for a long time, she had been there, and her mother died. And when they were drafting the notice of the mother's death, they included the fact that she'd been survived by her daughter and her daughter's partner, and she was discharged by the Catholic Church, by the Catholic school where she was working. I'm not exactly sure how that would play out in this country, because I think there are some fairly onerous civil requirements on employment that are pretty hard to get around. So I think it might be difficult to fire the woman who is already working at the Catholic school as a nurse, even elementary, secondary, whatever, seminary. I think it would be difficult to discharge her based on the fact that she had gotten married to a same-sex partner. Again, we're back to model one, right? And so it's really going to be fairly minimalistic, and that's the way that the government is heading on this bill.
We can move a bit from the employment issues and towards children. In a same-sex couple marriage relationship, the other partner, who if they have a child, obviously two people of the same sex can't have a child together. So only one of them would be a biological father or mother. In a same-sex marriage, when there is a divorce, do they have equal rights to custody over a child, or does only the biological parent have the right, and the other one is just?
In this country, we allow dual parent adoption for same-sex couples. So, because of that, the rights would be allocated the way that they are with married couples, according to the best interest of the child. So if there's a presumption in favor of one gender, that might be true. But generally, there will be just a decision based on best interest. As long as it's adopted, or if they're married, if both names appear on the birth certificate. So if it's by a surrogate. But they'll be treated like an opposite sex couple.
But opposite sex marriage, there's a presumption of parenthood. How does that relate to the special case of same-sex couples?
Well, to the extent that there's a presumption for the biological parent, there will be a presumption for the biological parent. Right. They'll be treated the same. Okay? Mm-hmm. So if in a same-sex couple you have one biological parent and you normally have a presumption for a biological parent, and there aren't other reasons that say the adopted parent or the non-biological parent should have more rights. I was involved in a case in Colorado where a father who had adopted his wife's daughter from a previous relationship ended up with sole custody. So you can get parents who are bad enough parents that they end up losing their children, whether they're biological parents or not. The judge is supposed to be focusing on where that child will do the best, what's in the best interest of that child. And you need to have visitation, parenting time, all the things that normally would affect you.
So if the same-sex marriage bill is passed in England, what will the situation be for Christian teachers who don't want to teach positively about same-sex marriage, and will it differ between state and private schools?
This one is the thing that my mind keeps going to when people ask this question a lot of are, What's the policy now in terms of Roman Catholic church schools teaching about divorce? Because you can be basically excommunicated from the Roman Catholic Church if you are divorced and then remarried. And so I think they're perfectly, I think they're allowed to teach that. That's Catholic doctrine. So I think they can certainly teach, we don't approve of same-sex marriage. I don't think there's any question about that. The question is, in the national curriculum, they're required to actually say what the legal things are. But certainly there's no reason that they can't pair that right up with Catholic doctrine on contraception, on... So I think what we have, again, if we're thinking about fighting fair and about making this debate really work, one of the things we can talk about is religious equality. I mean, there are denominations in this country, most notably the Church of England, that have a clear advantage over other denominations and other religions. And that, in my view, can lead to a lot more problems than having equal treatment and making sure that religious freedom and religious freedom is protected straight across the board. Now, I'll tip my hand and say I think that religious freedom can extend fairly far, so that when we're talking about fraternal lodges or when we're talking about fairly crazy beliefs, I think those have to be considered right along with the rest of them. So that, I mean, given the history, for example, of Protestants treating Roman Catholics really, really badly, I think it's hubristic for us to think that we can absolutely make determinations now about which denominations should be just completely ignored, right? But nevertheless, as Christians, I do think that we're entitled to have accommodation, and I think we're entitled to have it based on the fact that it's a religious belief.
Would that still hold in a non-religious school, so if you're just teaching in a secondary school?
Sorry?
So the example you gave seemed to sound more like if you were teaching within a religious school, but a faith school, but if you were teaching within a normal state school, would you...
In a state school, it's going to be a little bit different, right? I mean, in a state school, I think... I don't know what teachers in state schools are allowed to say. I certainly think they're allowed to at least say what their own beliefs are, as long as they portray them as their beliefs. And say that they're... My understanding of the way that, for example, religious education kinds of topics are taught, based on the very limited, tiny sample of my students who have discussed this with me, is that it's so bland anyway. I mean, it's just this stuff about, okay, and so I had a kid who was actually from a fairly, I don't know what his background was, but he really tried to write a nice theoretical paper about what the problems were and what the, about abortion. For an RE class, and he said he got like a 65 on it, and looked, and what they were supposed to do was say, some people believe this, and some people believe this, and this is another possible belief people could have, and then turn it in, and then you get a 70. So he turned in those papers. So, I mean, I think we'd be better off if we had more people saying, yeah, Roman Catholics think this is why. Give me good reasons not to believe those things. But I don't think that kind of debate is really encouraged in secondary classrooms on anything. But, and so, and your question is a positive one, not what I think. But I think that there's an awful lot of self-censorship that goes on a lot of things. And I think this is just going to fit into that general pattern of being pretty taboo and stuff.
Does that analogy hold to divorce? Given the differences between same-sex orientation and divorce. So within the states, same-sex orientation is a protected class of certain sort of person, whereas divorce is obviously, divorcee is not an orientation, that might be something that's clearly going on and whatnot.
But marital status is protected under the Equality Act. So that ends up being a legally protected status. For different reasons, but I think the analogy would hold. Yeah.
Sorry, got another one. Coming back to the question about children, an argument that you sometimes hear is that we don't know about the effects that gay marriage will have on the next generation. Has anything empirically been, any empirical research been done into that? And do what happens to...
Well, the comparators aren't there yet, right? Because if you're going to do it right, you have to have a good experiment, and that means you have to have a lot of married same-sex couples and a lot of married opposite-sex couples so that you can compare the way that they raise children. The data is that the genders of the parents don't matter that much. That's the data. Now, they're all kind of, this is one of these ones that's gotten really dirty because there was this study that was, and I'm going to blank on the author of the name of the author, but it's one of the studies that's been relied upon by the opponents of same-sex marriage very heavily. And it ends up that it was funded by interested parties, and they knew what the result was going to be before the study began. That was all. It's all kind of, and I think the Koch brothers are involved in it, and all kinds of. It's just not. It was not a. It was not a brilliant moment in the history of social science.
It did pass review though by the University of Texas. That's Mark Regnerus's study.
Regnerus. That's the name.
And he was audited by UT Austin for it. And he was cleared of all of that.
So that's all a bit...
It was peer-reviewed as well, blindly. And the person who disagreed with him in the same journal actually commended it as the premier study so far.
Really?
So
am I wrong about the data? You think that the data runs the other way?
No, I actually think that conservatives were wrong in Regnerus' study. It doesn't prove what conservatives thought that it proved. But it was a legitimate study.
Okay.
It was just badly interpreted by every conservative out there.
Okay. So, and it's really interesting, if you go online and see the briefs that were filed in the two Supreme Court cases that are pending, I think both, but at least one, has two or three briefs filed by social scientists claiming that social science is rubbish. It's like, the other guys may say all this stuff, but you know, the whole method, social science doesn't really do anything, and you can't trust it. So it's like, oh my God, guys, let's not do that. So that's, I'll leave it on that note, the fighting fear. I mean, I think it's really important to start out with the idea, and I think I can claim this as Christian. I think it's really important to start with the fundamental assumption that both sides have good intentions, and then go from there and say, okay, now I have these beliefs and I'd like to be able to talk about them with you, and let's talk about facts that we can understand each other talking about, and then we'll be better off and we'll be talking about the right things rather than talking about the wrong things and arguing about things that just won't matter in the long run.
Ultimate question does this present the your idea of fighting fear? I mean, to me, it doesn't. As a Roman Catholic, the reason I disagree with same-sex marriage is not because I think that I'm going to be fired from my job in a school, or I'm not going to be allowed to speak freely or whatever. The reason why I disagree with this is because I think that it's going to make the world worse, a worse place to be. So. All of this basically presents how we can just live together, and I know that we can live together, and we can make this, you know, we can make everyone play by the rules if you want, and we can set the rules, and so everyone has their rights, and no one can, you know, discriminate, or they can under very special circumstances, blah blah blah. But it still doesn't answer my question. You know, I don't oppose it because I'm going to lose my freedom of speech or freedom of that or freedom of whatever. I oppose it on a completely different grounds of I have a personal belief, which I obviously cannot prove because it's not, it doesn't come to exact, you know, facts or whatever.
Hypothetical about the future.
But yeah.
Yeah, and I think that's a hard argument to answer. And I get that. And I think that we all need to take that really seriously. I'm not sure that you can build public policy on fears, but I do think, for example, that you can make a good argument in response to me when I say that we don't have the data to be able to compare what will happen with same-sex parents who are married as opposed to opposite-sex parents. I mean, I think this is a good argument for, okay, then let's wait and see what happens with civil partnership, because that was the step we took fairly recently, and I'd like to see that build up more data. That's a conservative argument that I think works reasonably well. I don't like having them complain about the fact that there hasn't been enough consultation. But I can see one where we say, look, we've got a body of evidence that's building up now, and these changes are happening very, very suddenly, and I'd like to see what the real empirical data is on civil partnerships and how their children grow up. Say panel studies, and say 5 years, right? Would you be willing to, okay, here's the bet on your fear. Would you be willing to reconsider in 5 years if we could build up the data on civil partnerships? Or am I, okay.
No, the thing is, first of all, I wouldn't laugh so lightly at the argument, which, I mean, admittedly, it does sound, at first glance, it does sound ridiculous that social sciences are, just not that, they don't matter. I think, on one hand, it is a laughable argument, and it's certainly not fair, it's not fighting fair. But there is something to that. I mean, a human being is very complex. I mean, in social sciences, have a set of, a questionnaire has like 30 questions. And the questions would be like, do you feel that because you have had same-sex parents in relation to your peers who had a mother and a father, do you feel less secure about your personality or whatever? And then that would be like a set of, given answers. So you would pick something like, I very strongly disagree, or I somewhat agree. It's simplifying the human being. I mean, the human psyche doesn't work like I very strongly agree. I mean, it doesn't say why he's very strongly agrees. So there is that. And on another level, there's the way that we have lost the battle over contraception was that. Basically, people said, well, you have a pill, or a condom, or any means of contraception, and it's on the shelf. You can go into the pharmacist, and you can buy this thing, or not buy it. It's just a freedom of choice. So it doesn't change anything. But, I mean, we were never afraid that, I am going to be forced to buy this. We were just afraid that this was going to make the world a worse place. And now we see that it has made the world a worse place, that there's no talk of chastity anymore. We have divorce. We have talk about same-sex marriage. This is exactly what the Catholic Church was saying. Mm-hmm. In a few mm-hmm. generations, you're mm-hmm. going to have polygamy, you're going to have same-sex marriage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the thing is, why I'm not risk 5 years is because we are not going back. There's no way that we can just go back to banning contraception, making it illegal. There's no way that I can say, well, look what it has done to us, everyone. There's relationships are not being faithful, marriage is falling apart. There's nothing at all. Let's just go back to that. Let's make contraception illegal. There's no way we can just go back. It's right.
No, it's a ratchet.
Yes,
it's a ratchet. And this is a public policy argument. Right? Once you get started on something, and you make these steps in one direction, you can't reverse direction. Mm. And I get that. I mean, I think the Quakers think that the ratchet's moving in the right way. And so we've got some fundamental disagreements about what to do. And I mean, my best answer is, I think that there has to be room for people like you, so that you at least have ways of not violating your conscience. Now, it might be okay for you, I don't know where you work in the university, but I'm sure there are a lot of places in this university where you could feel like you were having your conscientious principles violated on a fairly regular basis. by having to do different kinds of things. And I think there has to be room for people like you to make sure that you can do things, including probably engage in commercial activity like running a bed and breakfast, without feeling like you're violating important fundamental religious principles. But that's, I think that's the best that society can do. And I think you also have a right to have beliefs like those treated with integrity. And nothing, I spent about 5 years of my law career defending a principle like this, and nothing makes me quite as irritating as someone who has really strong beliefs about something like that being treated dismissively, especially by the government. I think that's just absolutely something that should never be tolerated. So I'm not sure we agree on the principle, but I think we agree. And I think you can make arguments that are very damaging to my position, which I'm glad you haven't made, because I'd have to go back and try to read the book, based on the fact that I'm assuming a lot of the principles, I mean, once you get roles in the original position in here, a lot of the fundamental principles are just going to follow. But I do think that it's coherent with trying to arrange a liberal society in a democracy. And I think we have to take those as given. I don't want to. Those are two of the ones that I hope we can agree we don't want the ratchet to move back. So if we can start with those principles, then I'm sympathetic with the fact that I think some of this may be at least partially circular, in the sense that once I've set up the Rawlsian liberal democracy, we're going to have to allow for some positions that we disagree with fairly vehemently. Does that begin to address your? But I get it. I mean, I.
All right, folks. Well, our time is up in this room. We'll have to call it quits there. But everyone is very, very welcome to hang out and grab a drink and continue the conversation downstairs. But let's just thank Scott one more time for talking to us.